Today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
This time last year, you might remember, I spoke to solicitor Sarah Grace about the night she was attacked in her apartment and the court case that followed. I just want to recap some of what happened in 2019 for you, bearing in mind that some might find the details of the attack upsetting. It was the night of Wednesday, July 17th, 2019, when Sarah was attacked in her own apartment. Despite having the security latch engaged on her window, she woke in the night to find a stranger in her room on her bed. Ibrahim El Ghanoui of No Fixed Abode was sentenced to 10 years in jail for the assault. He had 33 previous convictions. Now, during the attack, he attempted to strangle Sarah. He violently penetrated her with his fingers and caused internal damage. Sarah managed to escape her attacker and raise the alarm with her flatmates. Now, she's gone on to write a book about her experience with a view to helping other people to navigate the legal and psychological challenges. It's called Ash and Salt. It's published by O'Brien Press. And I'm delighted to say that Sarah Grace is here with me now. Sarah, it is lovely to meet you in person. Thank you very much for being here. I know from talking to you last year on the programme that the experience profoundly impacted you, and you have this deeply held conviction to improve the system for survivors. So is the book part of that mission? Is that why you sat down to write it?
Yeah, 100%. So, you know, my story is done. There's nothing I can do to change what happened to me. But the book is very much designed as a survival guide for survivors. And what I do is I follow my story, but I divide it into topics. And at the end of each chapter, there's a checklist for survivors to know what to do. And it kind of it follows the healing journey from beginning to end. So from the assault all the way through the police investigation, the medical examination you have to go through, and then, you know, PTSD, extreme emotions like anger. And then we move on to the trial, if you get to trial, and what to do after, what to do about going public. So that's
it reads like a manual, because you have the descriptive part of the book, and then you have these sections where it is that this is the do's and don'ts of this particular situation. And I assume you're writing this wishing that you'd had this guide when you were going through this.
That's exactly it. So before I wrote the book, I was actually writing a checklist for the DPP and working with Minister Helen McEntee to do a checklist for survivors. The idea of the book was proposed by O'Brien Press, and I found it interesting to have not just a manual, but a story. So you can read it as a manual and skip the checklists, or you can dip into the checklists as you need to get the resources you need. But it gives you a good example of how those are applied in practice through my own story. Taking into account every survivor is so different, so it'll be a case-by-case basis.
Will you explain the title to me, Ash and Salt?
I get this asked a lot. So I speak a lot in images in the book, and Ash and Salt, surprisingly, is about healing. So ash is self-explanatory. It's the symbol of destruction and finality. And when I explain the impact of sexual violence, I use the image of a volcano that blasts a hole through all aspects of your life, and you feel like everything has been reduced to ashes. But actually, volcanic ash is the most fertile type of soil in the world. And a huge amount can grow and flourish from those ashes if you put the work in. So salt, on the other hand, is toxic. Salt in the land is poison. And legend has it, when the Romans took the city of Carthage, they burnt it to the ground and sowed salt over the ashes to make sure nothing could grow from it. So I use salt as an image throughout the book of things that hinder your healing and that you need to clear away from the ashes if you want to regrow. So there are things like toxic thoughts, toxic friends, toxic behaviors. Throughout the book, I just explain how to clear those away and focus on regrowing from the ashes.
And you talk as well about, you know, managing your own trauma, working through that, but also dealing with other people and how they dealt with what you had been through. That sounds as though it was almost as difficult to navigate in ways.
Yeah, in many ways, I found that harder than the attack itself, which sounds strange to say, but maybe because, one, it was over a prolonged period of time, and two, it was from, you know, closest friends, mentors, people I looked up to that didn't know how to handle this. And I remember being on that side before being a survivor. I remember not knowing how to address things like this. And it's not just sexual violence, by the way. It's any huge trauma, you know, someone who loses a loved one or any type of trauma, it's really difficult to know what to do. So I have a whole chapter in the book which, instead of speaking to the survivors, really speaks to the network, you know, employers, friends, families, and tries to give very practical examples of what you can do and what you shouldn't. And in my situation anyway, and I know a lot of survivors have echoed this to me, the best thing you can do is reach out and speak to the survivor and just tell them that you're there. And no matter what you say, I understand the fear of saying something wrong or putting your foot in it, but no matter what you say, what will come out of that conversation is they are on your thoughts, you're worried about them, and you want to be there for them. Mm-hmm. And you're not letting them withdraw and become invisible, because sexual violence is one of the most isolating things you can go through. It's such a taboo subject. Nobody wants to talk about it. Understandably, it's not a comfortable conversation to have. But I really focus on putting your comfort aside and making that effort, because I can promise you that that effort, the survivor is going through 100 times that every day.
One of the really touching and sad moments in the book I found was when your mother wanted to reach out and touch you. And this was in the days after the attack, wasn't it? And you just couldn't in that moment have her touch you.
I couldn't bear to be touched. So shortly after the assault, I think 2-3 days afterwards, I couldn't bear anyone touching me, but especially my family. And they were the only, you know, we kind of moved to a house outside of Dublin where my aunt was living, and there was nobody around but my family. And you'd never tell from my accent, I'm French, my mom is French. So they're very touchy-feely, which, you know, we're a very affectionate family. And we couldn't do that anymore. And it wasn't even touching. It was having someone near me that I thought may reach out to touch me. That would trigger panic attacks. So I needed people to stand at, you know, a safe distance. And I'd often find myself building furniture forts with chairs between us to make sure they couldn't come near me.
Could you articulate that at that time?
No, because it was the first time I was going through it. And, you know, it really, like that image of the volcano, it's that violent of, in a split second, your life does a 180 and all your markers in life are gone. All your past behaviors, relationships with people, everything changes. It's so overwhelming, and you're just trying to deal with the immediate aftermath, you know, come to terms with what has happened to you, the fact that you are now a rape victim or a sexual violence victim. For a lot of women, that's something you never want to admit. And then on top of that, you have to navigate relationships with friends, families, romantic partners, whatever it is. So no, I couldn't really explain it to her. We had conversations afterwards where I tried to explain, and then they took it so literally that they literally would stand on the other side of the room at all times. So it's a lot of communication both ways. And I would say that to both survivors and non-survivors, it's about communication. Mm-hmm. And just open the lines of communication and don't get defensive, because this is difficult for everybody, not just the survivor. My mom suffered a lot. My dad, my sister, they all suffered hugely from this as well.
Going back, I know you don't want to dwell on the attack, but just reading your description of it again, speaking to you last year, I still marvel at your reaction in the moment, you know, your ability to find the fight. I mean, have you managed to analyse that, where that came from in the moment?
Yes, I've done a lot of research on this because I find this fascinating. So my go-to Bible on trauma is The Body Keeps the Score by Dr. Bessel van der Kolk. I hope I'm not butchering his name. But essentially, in response to stress or trauma, the brain goes through these four different reactions. We know fight or flight, that's a common term, but there's two others, which are freeze or fawn. And a lot of women have told me exactly what you say, Claire. I would have frozen in the moment. But actually, all of those four responses are equally designed to save your life. And when you read the book, and I do go into detail as to what was going through my mind when it happened, my first thought was freeze and fawn. So I the first words I said was, what's happening? In a hope to dissuade or appease my attacker. And it's only when I tried to then get away, which was flight, and I was chased by him, that fight kicked in. Mm-hmm. Fight usually is not the way to go, because if the person is stronger than you, if they have a weapon, if anything goes wrong, you are going to get hurt. So flight should always be your number one response. Sometimes you don't have the choice on either of those, so you go to fawn or freeze.
But you can't rationalise it in the moment. I mean, you don't think about those options.
No, you don't. And so in that book, they explain it really well that, again, when trauma happens or a dangerous situation, you have kind of three elements of your brain. And the smallest one, your reptilian brain, which is stay alive. Basically, there's nothing else. Everything else but that reptilian brain shuts down. And so the reptilian brain assesses the overall situations in nanoseconds. Like, your logical brain has nothing to do with this. Logic goes out the window. And given the situation, you will react in whatever way you do. So again, in the book, I explain, you know, a couple of the actions I took them before even forming the thought in my head. Mm-hmm. So strangling him back, for example, I didn't think strangle him back. It just happened.
It happened in the moment.
It's your body takes over. And this is a message I really want to emphasize for survivors. If you didn't fight, if you froze, if you fawned, whatever it is, that was not you. That was your body and your brain protecting you to make sure you survived. You're not a victim. You are a survivor.
Well, you talk to survivors and, as I say, you give them instructions as to what to do and what not to do. Yeah. Don't have a shower, don't wash your teeth, don't brush your hair. You refused offers of sleep. You wanted to get everything down on paper exactly as you remembered it in that moment. How important is all of that for people to know?
So that is crucial. And I think it's something that's not just specific to Ireland, but it's not explained to people in a police investigation, and it's for many police investigations, but particularly ones where there's been some physical form of assault. And there are things you need to do to preserve evidence. And so I make the argument in the book that we all know stop, drop and roll if you catch fire. I don't know about you. I've never seen anybody catch fire. I've never heard of anybody catching fire, but I've heard of many police investigations going wrong. So in the same way, I try to give advices on what to do and what not to do. And those examples you gave of do not shower, I understand the want to get that creature off you, but do not shower, do not brush your teeth, do not touch anything on your body or on the crime scene. That is critical if there's going to be a trial, but it is also critical for the police investigation. So the trial almost comes later. You can decide or not if you want to pursue that avenue, but it is crucial, not just for the investigation, but also for yourself, that you feel believed. You have something to back up what you're saying here. Mm-hmm. Because as I explain in the book, the amount of obstacles you will have ahead of you as you carry on through the justice system of always having to prove your point, even though you are the victim, and always having to back up what you're saying. And, you know, even without the criminal justice system, just in general, people not believing women when they say they've been assaulted. So every little bit helps. And it's also so empowering for you to take control of the situation in whatever way you can and preserve that evidence and know you did everything you could to make sure this went the right way.
Yeah, another striking moment from the book, and I know you mentioned it when you were on air with us. We had a big conversation about this. The justice system, the trial for you, worse than the assault.
Yeah. And I understand the weight of those words. I would take the attack again tenfold instead of going
That's
through the trial.
That's an extraordinary thing to say.
It is an extraordinary thing to say. And what I find really worrying is, you know, I'm a solicitor, so I'm not a litigator. I wouldn't have a lot of court experience, but I have studied litigation and I have been in court a couple of times. So I have some knowledge that maybe the average person might not have. And I was lost. It was a maze. There's no transparency. Nothing is explained to you. Things keep changing. You have no idea what you're walking into. You're also the only amateur witness going in, because every other witness that goes in will either be a specialist like the guards, the doctors that take the evidence off you, et cetera, et cetera. And then if the accused does go on the stand, he has a whole team, or she has a whole team, to prepare them for what to say.
Even down to the simple things, like you wanted a screen between you and the alleged perpetrator, now convicted. And that was difficult to get, but then you were still quite close to him in the courtroom.
It was a complete battle to get. And then I could not believe, so when the trial started on the first day, you're given the option to go into the empty courtroom and just get the layout of the land. I highly recommend you do this. Sit in the chair, get a sense for it, get comfortable. I couldn't believe how close you sit to the person who has done this to you. And even for the accused, say someone has been wrongly accused of something. If I was sitting in his chair and listening to this person spew wrong facts about what I did, I would not want to be sitting that close. You are in touching distance of each other. And there's no screen between you. There's no glass pane. They can sit next to a translator if they need one. The two guards that sit with the person are behind them. Mm-hmm. And the way you're laid out, the victim or, you know, the survivor is slightly closer to the judge than the accused is, which means I was very aware of how exposed my neck was to him. And my neck was one of the areas I could not bear to have touched because of being strangled by him. And that was so traumatic. And it almost came to the point where I said, I cannot do this. If the screen is not there, I will not physically be capable to walk into that room and sit next to this creature and do this.
And you say that, you know, people should consider this, and you'd never discourage anyone from seeking justice, but you need to consider the impact that it's likely to have on you.
Yeah, exactly. So again, the whole point of the book is I want people to make informed decisions and know what they're walking into. And if I had known a lot of what was going to happen, that would have alleviated so much of my stress going in. I was going into a black box. So I know a lot of people say, I couldn't go to court. I wanted to, but the DPP refused to prosecute, or we didn't have enough facts, or I didn't press charges in time, whatever it is. Some people may be afraid of going in. So I always say the decision is yours and yours alone. You can listen to other people's advice, but it's a gut decision as to what to do. Mm-hmm. And there's other options open to you, like restorative justice, which I talk a bit about in the book. But certainly there are so many obstacles that I want you to be aware of, because I'm trying to find a nice way to say this. The courtroom can be a playground for certain legal professionals because they use tactics that shocked me to my core. And I,
but their job is to defend somebody.
Absolutely. No. And they should. That, you know, I'm all for due process, and I'm all for giving your client the best possible trial and present all the evidence in their favor and cross-examine you. Of course, cross-examination is never going to be fun. I don't envy the barristers doing it. That said, there are some techniques that are used, both that happened in my case, which I won't talk about because I don't see the point, but also that I've heard through other stories, that are disgraceful. And there is an element of human psychology involved as well that I just want you to be prepared for, because the key thing is stay calm, do not get thrown by these tactics, get your point across, look at the jury, because they are the ones you need to convince, not the barristers, not the judge.
Mm-hmm. And you, in the aftermath of the case, you decided to go public. You spoke to the Irish Times, you spoke to us, and then you had meetings, didn't you, with the DPP and the, yep, with the Minister for Justice. Now, do you feel you made progress in those meetings, or where are things at now?
Absolutely. So we are making a lot of progress. And what I find very encouraging is everybody is invested in making change happen. So their head and heart are in the right place, for sure. Now, I completely understand that they operate in the institutions, and institutions are slow to change. So personally speaking, everybody I'm talking to is absolutely on board. I think change is going to take time, hence the book. And, you know, I talk in the book about certain legal provisions that need to go, like the seizing of your counselling records. That's going to take years to go. So in the meantime, I'm trying to make that provision obsolete so that the barristers can't rely on it. But what I will say about the DPP and the Department of Justice is they have the patience I do not to, you know, work at this for years and years and years and change policies over time. So all of us were attacking this from different angles. I'm trying to attack it from helping the survivors, getting more open and understanding conversations with non-survivors, and particularly men, because they're half the population. We need their voice and their input for cultural change. The DPP and the minister are working on policy changes, institutional changes, and more power to them.
How is your life now?
To be honest with you, I've never been happier.
Like, so your life has changed
drastically.
Completely.
Yeah, completely. But, you know, and I was very happy before, but now I suppose I'm, one, very appreciative to be alive. So I don't take that for granted. And as a result, I do things that I might not have done in my previous life, because I think, why am I so afraid to go ahead and do this? Like, what have you got to lose? And, you know, I wouldn't have done that in my previous life. It took a near encounter with death to do that. And most importantly to me, I know I'm helping people. A few people have reached out, you know, a number of survivors have reached out and said, this is helping. And that's, I feel like that's my calling in life, is to help people. It's just, it gives me such a sense of purpose. Mm-hmm. And the fact that after I went public, and, you know, even the publication of this book, the torrents of encouragement and positive messages coming in, they just give me so much positivity and strength. And I want to share that. I don't want to linger on the anger and the injustices, because there's a lot. But I'm trying to focus on the positives.
Yeah. Well, it's great to meet you,
you
Sarah.
You too, likewise.
The best of luck with this book. It's out now, as we say. It's called Ash and Salt. It's published by O'Brien Press, and it's in all good bookshops. Thank you very much, Sarah, and we wish you well.
Thank you so much, Claire.
Okay, we'll take a break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.